Welcome to Them Before Us on American Family Radio, where we strive to put children before adults. Our goal is to educate the public on a child-centric perspective of marriage and family and represent the rights of children on policy matters. Now, here's the host and founder of Them Before Us, Katie Faust.
Welcome back to Them Before Us Radio. It is great to have you here after an eventful week. We're so grateful that you're giving us an hour of your time. This is the radio show where we're going to talk all things children, and we're going to give a special election focus on kids in this episode of the radio show. But we always kick things off with a little bit of Bible time. While I've been going through Exodus, there was a passage that stood out for me in my reading with my 15-year-old. I read different books of the Bible with different kids before they head out to school. And we were going through 1st and 2nd Timothy a couple weeks ago. And there are so many warnings that Paul gives against false teachers that creep into the church. And there's this one part specifically that says, "For among them are those who enter into households and captivate weak women, weighed down by sin, led on by various impulses." Like, there's something about women that make them particularly vulnerable to bad teaching. And let me just say that I've really seen that this week on election-related issues, especially older women. I've noticed, you know, my husband has been a pastor for a couple decades, and I've watched women who, you know, kind of in their prime, were strong and confident. And then as they age, they get cautious and they get worried and they get anxious. And it is so easy for somebody to come in and take advantage of them. And so I've actually seen that so much this week in the election, post-election, especially my older women friends who lean left. They're absolutely petrified because those false teachers, they're not necessarily coming in through the door of a church. They're coming directly into these women's lives through radio programs or through the news media, and they are panicking these women. You know, some of the things that these women think are going to happen to them after Trump assumes the White House are completely unhinged from reality, but these women are petrified. And I think how awful that these false teachers, you know, who I would just say like these pundits, who are using that kind of later stage of life where women especially tend to get a little more anxious and a little more cautious, that they are capitalizing on that and terrifying these women. So it is a good lesson for us to reinforce relationships with everybody, of course, but especially, I would say, with the older people in your life who might be a little more vulnerable, a little more susceptible. And it's not obviously not just people on the left. I know that there are people who, for example, only watch Fox News, and they can get so riled up about something that maybe does not necessarily deserve that level of emotional attention. You, Christian, you know, one of my favorite Bible verses is keep your head. In all situations, keep your head. You know, be grounded. Don't allow yourself to be tossed like a wave by every wind of doctrine. Don't allow yourself to be tossed by every headline. Keep your head and then stay connected, especially to these older people, because in times like this, you might be that little bit of sanity that helps them get through this week. We are going to tackle some of the election news. I've got my engagement director, Patience Sunny, here today, and she really is the Them Before Us kind of go-to when it comes to legal issues and policy issues. She's going to give us quite a rundown related to what we saw take place in connection and in relation to children's rights across the country this week. So, Patience, welcome aboard, and it's great to have you.
Great to be here.
First of all, just some general thoughts. Do you have some kind of gut response feedback or thoughts on the election? Personally, I was thinking, man, you know, those last home stretch, the last few weeks of the campaign, we saw Harris and Walz roll out ads, in essence, telling people that you need to vote for them to protect pornography. You need to vote for them to protect casual sex. They had ads that showed, you know, in essence, women defying their husbands in the voting booth. They had ads showing that, you know, there was a white conservative congressman that is responsible for your wife's death because she couldn't get the abortion that she wanted. I mean, like, I was like, wow, you're kidding me. Those were not compelling arguments? Crazy. I mean, I just think I'm really glad that those messages didn't land with people, or at least land enough to the point to persuade them to vote for Harrison Walz, because it was terrible, terrible at the very, very end there. And I'm glad that, you know, we were able to reject the candidates, the platform that overwhelmingly, I think, would have been not just bad for kids, but, you know, bad for adults as well. What were your thoughts, Patience?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the important thing is that both teams had a good time, right? But in all seriousness, those ads at the end were a little unhinged. And something that I've been seeing, you know, in my social media feeds and among people I know, similar to what you were saying in Bible Time, is the fear that those ads really did capture with some people, which is disappointing and frustrating because they were dishonest. You know, the one with the women with conservative husbands voting liberal because they're free to do that in the ballot box. That was just such a dishonest portrayal of what a lot of conservative marriages look like. It's not coercive for a woman to disagree with the left. I think that was definitely an unhelpful approach and ultimately one that was not persuasive to a lot of voters. I think there are a lot of very common sense voters that weren't buying that. As a former Minnesotan, I was pleased to see that Harris Walz lost Blue Earth County, which is Walz's home county in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've talked in the past about some of the radicalism that Governor Tim Walz has forced on Minnesotans in recent years. It was encouraging to see, even though they did end up winning Minnesota, that a lot of Minnesotans have chosen to reject that radicalism. I thought it was disappointing on Kamala's part that she did not address her supporters when it became clear that she had lost. I thought that was a pretty disappointing failure of leadership on her part, because at this point, these are people who have invested in her campaign, believed in what she's saying, and she didn't show up for them. So that was, you know, disappointing, even as someone who doesn't personally lean left politically. I would have liked to see her show that kind of leadership to the people that invested in her campaign. Looking down ballot, there are some ballot initiatives that are definitely worth looking at from a children's rights perspective as well. We've talked about some of those in the past, but we've got results on those now as well.
Yeah, well, let's run through them. Let's start with California's Proposition 3. We had talked about this. This was to, in essence, enshrine the right to marry in California's constitution. And that sounds innocuous, but they don't define what it means to have a right to marry. And opponents are very concerned that it opens the door to all different kinds of marriages, you know, even ones that might be underage, ones that could be incestuous, obviously polygamous marriages. It removed the language of one man, one woman that had been installed during the Prop 8 debates. So that was approved. And that slope, it's just going to keep slipping. Like at some point, you've got to just stand firm and say, no more, no more. Like this hasn't led to anything fruitful or healthy. I mean, all it is just more adult validation, with kids ultimately paying the price. Hawaii and Colorado also had some marriage amendments that passed. Do you want to tell us about those?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so these were considerably less sweeping than California's. California, as you said, had a lot of really concerning implications to that marriage amendment when you've created an undefined right that is going to open the door to polymarriage, potentially underage or incestuous marriage. Hawaii and Colorado were both removing one man, one woman marriage from their state constitutions. Hawaii, actually, the language that they were removing was whether or not the legislature has the authority to define marriage as between one man and one woman. And that goes back to a legal battle that they had about 30 years ago over that question. So they're removing the legislature's authority over marriage. And then Colorado was just removing one man, one woman marriage from the Constitution. And obviously, Obergefell has already done that on a national level, saying that there's a right under the U.S. Constitution to same-sex marriage under that ruling. But what we're seeing is a lot of groups on the far left are saying, well, if Dobbs was overturned, we can't just rely on Obergefell as the redefinition of marriage. We need to do this on the state level as well. So that's what we're seeing with these Hawaii and Colorado marriage amendments. It is, you know, disappointing to see states removing the acknowledgement of what marriage is, but also those particular initiatives aren't going to have an immediate impact on what is legal in the state the way that California's might.
Yeah, good. Well, so marriage was on the ballot in a couple states, but there was a lot of measures that dealt with life. So tell us about the seven states that passed anti-life ballot initiatives.
Yeah, so seven states, there were 10 states total that had life amendments on the ballot. Seven of those states passed anti-life initiatives. One of the ones that I'm watching is Missouri. It was disappointing to see that one pass. They've historically been a pro-life state. Their initiative doesn't immediately roll back pro-life protections, but it opens the door to rolling back those pro-life protections. Another one that's a big deal is New York's Proposition 1. And that one is, again, not super surprising that it passed. We've got a similar state to California politically. But New York's Proposition 1 was not merely a question of whether or not there's a right to abortion, but went further than that, also declared gender identity a protected status, which has significant ramifications for women and girls' privacy and safety in spaces like locker rooms, restrooms, showers, as well as athletic opportunities. You know, if you've decided that gender identity is a protected status, that has serious implications for girls' sports. And that was actually the issue that had advocates for Proposition 1 concerned that it might not pass. There was a moment a few weeks ago when the general climate on that question was such that a lot of abortion groups were concerned that New York was going to vote no on Proposition 1. They ultimately did pass it, roughly 60-40%. But that issue of girls' sports really did get a lot of attention and did get the attention of a lot of voters, because even people who lean left can find some common ground on wanting their girls to have those athletic opportunities. The other concerning thing would be, again, like the California amendment, it doesn't have any sort of age restrictions on it. It simply says gender identity is a protected status, which raises the question of, will that mean that further down the line, because of this amendment, someone finds a right to transition a minor against their parents' will? And that would also be very concerning from a children's rights perspective, to have the parent-child relationship cut off in that way through that amendment.
Well, there's a lot of room for growth. I think that the pro-life movement really has its work cut out for them as it relates to how do we use this new freedom to advance pro-life laws in the wake of the overturning of Roe versus Wade in a way that is effective. And it looks like we've figured out how to do that, at least in Florida. Florida was a very bright spot when it comes to passing, defeating Amendment 4, which would have overturned their significant pro-life protections. So that was a huge win. And I really think it's because instead of just being sort of sheepish about it, you had top-down leadership saying, this is what it is. Let me educate you. You do not want this. This is not good for Florida. And they were able to shoot it down. So that's what we need to do, right? More education, more child-centric narrative, more talking about the importance of children's rights and why we need to protect them. Stay with us. We've got more election news coming up.
Welcome back to Them Before Us on American Family Radio.
Well, there's no shortage of election information and news to cover. There was a lot that took place across the nation, not just the election of a new president, but a lot of initiatives that really are going to have a serious impact on the children of this country. We discussed a couple of them in the last segment, but there's more, right? We did see a pro-life win in the state of Florida, thank God. But we also got some good news out of South Dakota and Nebraska. And my engagement director, Patience Sunny, is here with me, and she is going to tell us a little more about what happened in South Dakota and Nebraska.
Yeah. So, you know, like in Florida, we saw wins for life in South Dakota and Nebraska. Both of these are states that already have protective pro-life laws in place. And they said, you know, we want to keep that. South Dakota had a question on the ballot. Is there a right to abortion? Very similar to Florida's Amendment 4. And like Florida's Amendment 4, it would have walked back South Dakota's pro-life protections. Nebraska's an interesting one because what they had on the ballot were actually two different life questions. One was, is there a right to abortion that we need to enshrine in the Constitution? And the other was, are we going to enshrine in the Constitution protections for preborn babies up to after 12 weeks? So reinforcing their existing pro-life law in their state constitution. And what's interesting is, you know, voters are being asked about both of these things, and both came really close to that 50% mark. The life amendment did end up passing. It got more votes. But I think what we're seeing is an information gap among voters. Just looking at those numbers, you know, it's within the realm of possibility that there were voters who voted yes on both, which is really kind of wild to think about, but also demonstrates the confusion around this issue, especially when it's being presented as a ballot question. What does a right to abortion really mean? A lot of people don't realize that if you enshrine a right to abortion, that means no limits on abortion ever. And then also the fact that a lot of people are conflicted. And, you know, as pro-life, pro-child advocates, we don't want to see people being conflicted. We want to see people gladly embracing life and recognizing that children have a right to life at all stages, beginning at fertilization. But I think the Nebraska vote really does show where a lot of people are on the issue and shows the work that the pro-life movement has ahead of them in educating voters and helping people to understand the reality of abortion and the reality of what these initiatives would do, what a lot of pro-abortion legislators and lobbyists are pushing for. And similar to, you know, in Florida, we saw a massive shift. We've seen that that change can happen. Florida was a swing state not that long ago. And now it's not only not a swing state, but a state that their general voting population just voted to keep their heartbeat ban in place and say that there is not a right to abortion in the Florida Constitution. And that's a huge win for the pro-life movement, and I think very instructive going forward. Similar with South Dakota, they have a near total ban in place, and their voters chose to keep it. So I think it would be really valuable for the pro-life movement to be looking at those states and say, okay, what happened here? What caused that change? And I think it does go back to what you were saying in the last segment, Katie, with the leadership in Florida, where there wasn't any waffling on the issue. There wasn't the hedging of, oh, you know, maybe some abortions are okay. It was just, hey, this is what this initiative does, and this is why it's bad for Florida. And I think that really proved to be an effective strategy.
Yeah. IVF was, interestingly, a really big part of the debate as it related to the election debate, as it related to, you know, the top candidates on the ticket. There were not necessarily a lot of ballot measures that dealt with IVF. And if you're new to the issue, you can go to thembeforeus.com. You can go to our Fast Facts. There's a lot of information there about IVF. You know, too long don't read. IVF destroys more embryonic life every year than abortion and Planned Parenthood do. So that is why we are staunch opponents of IVF. But it was on the ballot in Illinois. So tell us what happened in Illinois.
Yeah, so Illinois was interesting. You know, a lot of these ballot measures that we've been looking at are constitutional amendments to the state constitution, which, you know, that's a significant change. It enshrines something as a right, makes it difficult, if not impossible, to pass future legislation dealing with that. But what Illinois passed was actually a non-binding measure. It was just kind of it almost like let's take an opinion poll, sort of, dealing with whether or not there's a whether or not insurance coverage should be expanded to include mandates for IVF coverage. So, you know, it doesn't really immediately affect what's going on in Illinois, but it is paving the way for saying, hey, insurance companies should have to cover IVF. And one of the things that people need to consider with that is everything that comes with it. Because, you know, a lot of people think about IVF through the lens of, oh, I know someone who had a baby through IVF. And so they see IVF and they see life. But the reality is, life is not what's happening in the IVF industry. The IVF industry is destroying hundreds of thousands of embryos. There are over a million embryos on ice in the United States. And mandating insurance coverage of IVF means mandating that these insurance companies are participating in that, that as you're paying insurance dues, you're contributing to that. And also, if you're going to say that there is a right to IVF, then the next step is that right needs to be applied equally. So like in New York, there's actually a case being litigated right now where two men are saying they have a right to IVF because their colleagues who also work for the city of New York have IVF coverage under their insurance plans. So with that expansion of IVF coverage, we would see an expansion of donor conception. We would see an expansion of surrogacy. Where does this apply to, you know, men in same-sex relationships if they have a right to IVF, or if this insurance company is going to be applied quote-unquote equally? And I think the reasonable stance of the insurance company is those men are not capable of receiving IVF, but that is not, it does not look like that's going to be the position of the courts in New York. So I think Illinois would be facing something very similar if the future of IVF is based on this measure that did pass, this non-binding measure in favor of expanding IVF coverage.
Yeah, it's very, very important how we use our words. What is a right? And, you know, we talked about it a little bit in the last segment. A right to marry, when you're not defining what marriage is, well, that actually can be pretty dangerous. A right to IVF sounds awesome, except that if a single man or double men or triple men have a right to IVF, what that means is they have a right to a motherless child. Mm-hmm. And obviously, if a heterosexual couple has a right to IVF, and that often means that insurance or maybe the state is going to subsidize the creation of many more embryos than they could ever parent or implant. And that would be, you know, a right to destroy dozens of little lives in pursuit of the one little life that they actually want. So we need to be really careful about how we think and talk about these kinds of things. Patients, what is next? Like, I would like your thoughts on whether or not the Democrat Party is going to moderate. Like, I look at the Harris-Walz campaign, and they put all their chips on abortion. You know, I saw Kamala struggling to articulate a strong position on a lot of different issues, trying to distinguish how she was different from Biden, work to kind of communicate, I would say, some pretty milquetoast talking points. But when she was really convincing and animated, it was when she was talking about abortion, right? That was the issue that she thought, this is going to get me over the finish line. But it didn't. It wasn't enough. So do you think that this is going to kind of force a little self-reflection on the Democrats moving forward? Do you think that they're going to change their strategy or their tone? And why do you think abortion wasn't enough to get them across the finish line?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think, we did see some pretty extreme radicalism. And even just looking at the candidates, these are two extremely radical candidates on abortion and on the issue of gender. Both of them have a pretty radical record on that. You know, there were ads against Kamala highlighting her advocating for taxpayer funding of gender transition surgeries for illegal migrants. And then, you know, as Attorney General of California, she prosecuted the people who exposed Planned Parenthood for selling baby parts that were harvested most likely during partial birth abortions. So as extreme radical as you can get in a candidate, and that clearly didn't work for the Democrats. I think part of that is that the Republican Party was working very hard to make sure that abortion was not the deciding issue in the election, but also I think the Democrats pushed too hard. And I think that we will see a moderation that happens as a result of that. I think that at least if the Democrat Party is being reflective, they will look at this and say, oh, hey, we are further left than our base is, and we are not going to win even our own base in the future if we continue to push this, much less the independent voters or the right-wing voters that we would need to be able to pick up in order to flip the White House next election cycle. So I think we will see some moderation, at least on the national level, from the Democrats. I think a question, though, is what we'll see on the state level, particularly in states like California and New York that have passed some pretty extreme measures now. Will that further embolden those state level parties to adopt growingly far left, increasingly far left positions? And I think that's something to be watching for, especially as, you know, in my role as engagement director, I've been monitoring Uniform Parentage Act bills that are moving through very blue states. And I think we will continue to see that. And it might take, you know, 5-10 years before we see the full effects of that legislation, which would be a concern from a perspective of how we're communicating with voters. You know, we're seeing the effects of the transgender push on how, you know, this is affecting detransitioners, how it's affecting girls' sports, and a shift in public opinion coming with that. And I think we will eventually see that on some of these other social issues as well. It's just a question of how long on the state level. So I think we'll see some moderation nationally and in states that were close, but in states that are deep blue, I think we will not be seeing that moderation.
I will be stunned if in any way they walk back the absolutist radicalism of their pro-abortion stance. To me, it is fundamentally ingrained in their worldview. Like it is as close to like an orthodoxy that you can get for progressives. I think for them to change or moderate in any way would take an entire self-evaluation that I'm not sure if they're in a position to undertake at this point. But I hope you're right. I hope there is some moderation. So the Republicans are now in the White House. They've got the Senate. They're poised to maybe take the House. I saw, you know, a panicked post saying, oh, no, the Republicans are going to have all three branches of government. Well, you can't really have the Supreme Court. But you're right. You don't necessarily have activist judges anymore that are going to be advancing liberal causes through the courts. But the Republicans that won stripped the platform of its pro-life language, and it's explicitly male and female marriage language. So as it relates to the not social issues in general, but life and marriage specifically, what do you think that we're looking at over the next 4 years? Do you think that we, even though it's not explicitly in the GOP platform, so my opinion is most of the people that are going to be staffing the administration are staunch social conservatives. So even if it's sort of written that we've softened on abortion and softened on marriage, I think that the people that are staffing the positions are probably extremely well-formed Catholics, Christians, conservatives, and they understand that there are there's sort of a hierarchy of issues. Life and marriage and religious liberty are at the top of that hierarchy. And if you don't get those three things right, you're not getting anything else right. So I do have some hope that even though they have not they have, I would say, unfortunately, compromised on that aspirational language. I do think that the Trump administration is going to be better for life and marriage than obviously the alternative. But what do you think, Patience? Do you think that the changing of the language is going to significantly change how the administration governs related to life and marriage issues?
I think, you know, throughout Trump's campaign, he's made it pretty clear that he doesn't want to touch the issue of abortion. And on Tuesday, when he was asked how he voted on Amendment 4 as a Floridan, he said, just stop talking about that. So I'm not hopeful that we'll see strong, proactive action on the life front under the Trump administration. You know, I hope I'm wrong about that. And I will say, you know, we've seen Trump being open to persuasion in the past. You know, back in 2016, he came out as pro-life. And I think he was genuinely persuaded, at least in regards to late-term abortions. I'm hopeful that he has some pro-life convictions for earlier abortions as well. But, you know, there's potential for him to maybe be persuaded by good staffers, which would not be the case under a Harris administration. I am concerned about what that's going to look like on the IVF front. He's shown himself to be very persuadable there in a negative way. But, you know, nevertheless, we have a president who is more friendly towards pro-child issues than we would have had under a Harris administration. And I think that is a good step, but it's also a reminder that as pro-child advocates, we need to be at the forefront and we need to be giving voice to children's rights issues.
Well, stay tuned. We are going to take your Q&A next related to how is it that we should interact in the political world.
If you'd like to comment on the show, email comments@thembeforeus.com. Once again, here's Katie Faust.
We are wrapping up our Them Before Us radio for this weekend. Have had some good conversations around the election, especially as it relates to kids. So we're going to do a little Q&A as it relates to what does it look like to do our civic duty and represent children well, and how is it that we're supposed to navigate this intersection between our faith and our politics? So we're going to answer some of your questions that you've sent in over the week. And Jen Friesen, my training director, is here to help me do that. Welcome back, Jen.
Okay, we've got a Trump administration. We've got full control. I was telling someone, we need to get hopping on it, though. You have 2 years if you've got full control. And then pretty generally, it seems like midterm elections swing a little bit more toward the center. Like you might lose one of the House or the Senate. So you've got 2 years to really get after it. But if we think about day one priorities for the Trump administration, or kind of that first 90 days from a pro-child politics perspective, what do you think are the big things we would love to see a Trump administration get after?
Well, I think that honestly, immigration is probably the most immediate, the most pressing. What is going on right now with such, not just a porous border, but a border that is literally controlled by Mexican cartels, is the trafficking of children. We are seeing the straight up trafficking of children across our southern border, children that are now disappearing into our country, maybe going to other countries as well. And they are never to be seen again. So right now, unfortunately, we are facilitating a massive human smuggling operation on our southern border because we have not allowed for an actual systematic, well-vetted process of people coming across the border. I hope that the Trump administration is going to take immediate action on that, because the human rights violations, the children's rights violations, are pretty egregious on that score. What do you think, Jen? What do you hope to see in the first 90 days?
I think I'd love the trans ideology kind of bans, or I'm not sure what would at the federal level they do. I think it's kind of the power of podium when you're a president, right? To go out and say no more federal funding if you're putting boys on girls teams, no more federal funding if you have boys in girls bathrooms, immediately remove men from women's prisons, mm-hmm. which Washington State is doing right now. I think people don't, Christians don't understand. There are men victimizing women in prison right now. And the reason to put them in women's prison is because those men will be victimized in men's prison, which is also wrong. So let's stop that and make sure that's not happening. But the answer
well,
is not.
Well, maybe. But I mean, they do it because they realize it's a cushy situation. And they've got there. They literally have a captive group of victims there. These women, when I was in Sacramento a couple of weeks ago, I was talking with several different lawmakers there. And they're like, you know, when you're installing condoms in women's prisons, you know, something is wrong. And that's where they're at.
Yeah. And I'm more referencing that men victimizing each other in men's prisons.
Oh, yes.
That's a thing that happens.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying then whether, yeah, men using it just to get out of men's prison, go victimize them, right?
Yeah.
But anyway, those seem like huge things we could. And it just seems like the majority of the country is pretty much on board with those things. This is not crazy. Men shouldn't hurt women in women's prison. Yeah. Okay.
I'm very curious to see what they do about the Department of Education. Mm-hmm. I know that there has been some talk about abolishing the Department of Education. This is actually a great idea. Education was never supposed to be a federal issue. It was supposed to be a hyper-local issue. Having a Department of Education has done nothing to elevate the learning standards and the achievement of kids. It has been an absolute massive resource suck from the federal budget. So I would love for them to put more control at the local level, give more control to parents to be able to move their kids to better schools, better districts, if that's what's best for them.
Yeah, if they take down the Department of Education and say it's the state's job to fund education now, and then there's school choice in the states, we are looking at maybe a shift in, you know, if a lot of kids are not going to public school anymore, and that's been sort of the primary ideological vehicle for the left.
Right.
So if they're losing that and they're losing, you know, all these other features, it is going to be interesting. So I guess I can understand the weeping and gnashing of teeth and stuff.
Right. Yeah. The loss of control is happening on a couple different areas, and that's not something that they are used to.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Continuing with our political thoughts and questions, what do you think about how vocal Christians should be when it comes to faith and politics and the intersection of that? Maybe we're talking about on social media. Maybe we're talking about how loud you are in your small group at church. Mm-hmm. Should we be vocal and really intersect our faith with politics? Should we come off more reserved, not post online, not seem partisan in order to kind of maintain unity?
So I actually think that Christianity informs everything, every aspect of our life. There's a quote by Abraham Kuyper that says, there's no part of creation where Christ doesn't look at it and cry out, mine, right? Every aspect, and I know that I didn't get that quote exactly right, but every aspect of life is touched by biblical truth. So whether you're talking about money and how to use your money, whether you're talking about how to steward your body, whether you're talking about how to form and maintain a great marriage, whether you're talking about parenting or whether you're talking about politics, biblical values, biblical truth has a lot to say, and not a lot, not just a lot, the most important things to say. So I actually think that Christians should be well-informed biblically about every area of life. And then we need to be speaking up and sharing that wisdom. I obviously think that you need to do that in a way that allows people to hear your message. You don't need to necessarily go in bull in China shop style and, like, you know, burn it all down. But there is a fire hose of progressive ideology as it relates to most political issues that is being aimed, especially at kids, but definitely at just kind of your ordinary mom and dad as well. And sometimes the church or Christians respond with silence, maybe just a little drip or a whisper here or there. And really what it needs is a robust apologetic for the good that stems from a biblical worldview. Like, we don't need to shrink back. We do need to speak up. We do need to talk about how biblical values inform things like how we steward the planet, how we protect the innocent, how we govern our nation, how we, strengthen the whatever fabric we need socially or nationally to ensure that the citizens of this country are able to thrive. There's aspects of things that only the government can do that ordinary citizens cannot do. And we need to advocate for the government doing the very best job it can in those areas. And then honestly, keeping their hands off of all the other things that families, communities, churches, and neighbors should be doing for one another. So I do think that we need to be vocal, not just about politics, but about everything. Don't be an idiot and don't be a jerk, because obviously the method of how you communicate is going to validate or invalidate your message. But I do think we need to be speaking up. Jen, you are like one of my favorite people to follow online on social media, because I think you engage so well. So I'd love to hear what you think about this.
I can't tell you the amount of times I've gotten in trouble for posting things online, but I think I have matured a lot from 10, 15 years ago. I was on Twitter, anonymously, just arguing with people just to argue. And it's crazy how angry it makes you sort of in your then normal life, where you're sort of unbearable to live with the people around you. So I really saw that that is not good. And I think being anonymous is not great either. It's definitely not good for me. Being sort of having a face and a name to your comments, I think, is very helpful in being like, well, people I care about could actually read this. That's a good gauge of, yeah, would I say this in person? Is probably a good indication of whether or not you should say it online. But I think what we say, especially going back and forth on social media, isn't often for the two people arguing. It's usually for the people watching. And I've just seen so many examples in my own life or in folks like Ali B. Stuckey, people saying, you changed my mind on being pro-life or not, because they were engaging with the things she was saying out loud. And I think it's okay if some people say, hey, it's not for me. I don't prefer putting all that stuff on social media. My social media is for my kids, my art, my whatever. But then they have those great conversations in person with the folks around them. I think that's awesome. But we do need people who do it online as well. So I think it's good to be thoughtful. I've learned definitely that it's better to throw some open-ended things out, or state your position and say, what do you think about that? And that invites a little more conversation and openness. I've had people say, well, you put something out and it basically says, if you disagree with me, you're stupid. And that's not a good starting point for those folks that then do disagree with you. I had someone disagree with me. I just posted a commentary someone did of Trump winning. And I had someone I care about disagreeing with me. But I think I disarmed it pretty quickly by saying, hey, I love you. I actually really like you. And I understand we are coming at this completely different. She thought I was brainwashed. I was like, in my mind, I'm seeing her say every single thing that, I've heard the talking points, and she thought I was brainwashed. So we don't have that good starting point, but I do think I disarmed the situation by communicating how much I cared about her right at the beginning when she was upset. So
that's such a good tactic. Always great to be able to bring it back to the personal and reaffirm that relational connection.
All right, final question. We've got schools canceling classes. We have companies saying, hey, don't plan any meetings this week. There's this acknowledgement that people will be depressed. And I'm wondering if you think that's a good or bad state of the union when it comes to our political discourse. And, that basically people have to take a week to be ready to lament if it goes a certain direction. And our country's kind of coddling that, it seems like.
Well, yeah, there absolutely has been a mental unraveling or, definitely some kind of frailty on that behalf of like mental, emotional. And they have been studying this for a while, and it is much more present on the progressive side of the aisle, that what we're seeing is if you lean liberal and if you're female, especially, you do tend to be struggling more with mental health issues. Like older progressive women are taking antidepressants and anti-anxiety medication at higher rates than any other demographic. And so something like this is very upsetting for them. But it speaks to something deeper, right? Like it speaks to a much deeper worldview. And I think it's just that you're going to believe in something Something is going to like capture your attention. Something is going to give you meaning and hope in this life. And unfortunately, for so many people, because we have decided to, not we, but many people have said, you know, I'm not going to put my hope in God. I'm going to detach from church. Unfortunately, a lot of these, especially older, more liberal women, have not formed families. All they have is politics. That's all they have. And when things don't go their way, and then especially when they're being fed these apocalyptic kind of messages that, you know, you're going to be a handmaid now, and, you know, you're going to lose all of your autonomy. I mean, if I believe those things were true, I don't know if I could attend a meeting either. And so I think it's sad, right, that we, number one, have people that are putting their hope in politics. And number two, that we have a news system. And by that, I mean the ability to absolutely silo ourselves and never hear a different perspective that might balance out the possibility that, no, you're not going to be put in a concentration camp on January 21st. I mean, it's terrible. So I think it speaks to the frailty of, you know, the mental health situation, especially on the left side of the aisle, unfortunately, the dysfunction of the way that we are getting our news these days, and the sadness of, you know, not having anything deeper and bigger to attach yourself to, other than who's going to be, you know, back in the White House in January.
Right. Well, that it does seem like conservatives are happier generally. I think there's been some even data to that point. And it's because we have a lot of other things we're engaging in. And like you're saying, if your primary identity is the things I'm against or for, and I have to chain myself to a building or lay in the road for climate change, and then you lose things like this, it can be excruciating. But as a culture, we do need to develop a little more, and especially at college level, right? Ability to handle things you disagree with.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, there was a little shade thrown at like single cat ladies and things like that throughout this election. But like everybody needs meaning. And if you're not getting it at church, in your family, in a deeply connected community, you'll make meaning for yourself. And unfortunately, a lot of people have decided that that is who is elected president. So good reminder for all of us to reach out if you can, build some bridges. Those people need you. They need you to engage with them, love them, and know them. Thank you so much for being with us this week, and we will see you next week.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.